What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
This week in the function room, number 49, the whole shebang. Coincidentally, we're watching here at home Dark, the very German and very excellent time-travelling TV series, which was made around the same time as Stranger Things, but it's better. So it's a great time to talk about black holes with Dr. John Regan, the Royal Society and SFI University Research Fellow in the Department of Theoretical Physics in Maynooth University. We carefully scrape the surface of the topic of black holes, without hopefully getting sucked in and destroyed by the weight of the topic. John tells me how he got into black holes and why he can't really get out, how Einstein nearly got it wrong, and then got it right, with a little help from his friends. What it's like as a black hole expert to look at that first photo that was taken, and is there a black hole in the room with us right now? There'll be a few terms and things referred to that might appear tricky, so best to give a quick explanation right now. General relativity. Einstein said that massive objects like planets and stars curve space and time around them, and that bendy curviness makes objects move in a way that looks like they're being pulled by gravity, kind of like a ball rolling along a curved surface. So, for example, the Earth curves space-time around it, which is why the Moon orbits the Earth. This is different to what Newton had said, which is just that two objects just sort of attract to each other. More complicated, and definitely explains a lot about the universe. Right, speaking of that kind of thing, gravitational waves. Now, not going to really be able to give a full explanation of this, A, because I don't know, and B, because it takes an entire century to have figured them out in the first place. But if you think of space and time as being like a sort of a fabric, a sort of a rubbery sheet, if you can think of a rubbery sheet, I don't know where you might have a rubbery sheet, but try and imagine a sheet made of rubber and big planets roll through them and stars making curvy dents in them, then gravitational waves are sort of events, like they're ripples in that fabric where something big happens, like black holes joining up or supernovas from stars. So Einstein figured out, as we'll get to later on, that these waves ripple through space and they stretch and squeeze and generally wrinkle space as they go. So he predicted them with mathematics. And then scientists, years later, decades later, with special kind of telescopes and measuring and sensors, they seemed to pick them up. And as we find out later, they were proved to be existing in 2015. So that's a long time after somebody did sums. So gravitational waves, they basically can help us find out what happened a gazillion years ago at the start of the universe. What else? Oh yeah, the photo of the black hole. This was back in 2019, where scientists made a telescope out of 8 telescopes, joined all up all of their images, all these 8 radio telescopes scattered around the world. They call it the Event Horizon Telescope. Then, using that and a load of data, they produced a snap of a black hole, which is 55 million light years away from Earth. So it was really a picture of how the black hole looked just after the dinosaurs disappeared. Now, surprise, surprise, in the picture, if you remember it, it was a black hole with a glowing circle around it. But it was a pretty big deal, as we shall see. Now, let's hear from John.
I'm John Regan. I'm a research fellow at Maynooth University. And what do? I try to understand the formation of black holes in the universe, in the early universe, really, because that's where we think they were all seeded. And by that, I mean, I think that's where we think that there's big black holes we see in like the center of galaxies. Take the one at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. It's absolutely massive. maybe we'll come back to that. But to get, and it seems like they were all born, if you like, or seeded is the word we use, in the very early universe. And by that, I mean within the first few hundred million years.
I found you because I'm on a mailing list of, you know, here are interesting talks people are giving at lunchtime in Maynooth, or, at, you know, here's an online seminar. The title of yours was, I think it was Everything You Want to Know About Black Holes But Were Afraid to Ask.
Too afraid to ask, I think.
So as not to have run into any copyright issues with Woody Allen or whatever. I feel like it's a topic that people are simultaneously afraid to ask, but also think they know a bit about, because of all the areas of maths and physics where there's some very difficult, interesting, fascinating, unknowable stuff going on, black holes are the thing we seem to be able to imagine. They capture the imagination, don't they?
They capture the imagination, I suppose, because they, you know, we have this image in our heads, maybe, that they, you know, suck in all of the whatever it is around it, you know, the matter and everything, and they grow and grow and grow. And that seems to be of great interest to people. I suppose they're enigmatic, right? Because we can't really describe them very easily. You know, you take a black hole on the one hand, and you compare it with a star beside it on the other, and people are less interested in the stars, but, you know, which is kind of crazy, because the star, of course, is far more important, gives out light and keeps us all alive and so on, like the sun does. Black holes, I don't know, like, they are fascinating objects, right? But it's not like we have any real, like, you know, real life feel for them, you know, like, yeah. They're always going to be at incredibly large distances. They're going to be rare, relatively speaking, you know, there's none really all that close to us that we really know about. You know, I suppose, you know, we'll never, they're hard to get a handle on, like, you know, for a number of reasons, you know, anything that goes into a black hole is permanently lost there. So we can't really probe these things, even if one of them is close, which they're not. But they seem to capture the imagination, I suppose, a bit through science fiction maybe as well. This kind of wormhole ideas, you know, that they'll somehow take us back in time, you know, these kind of more, you know, out there ideas. And maybe they've allowed scientists and maybe science fiction writers to kind of play with ideas a little bit. Maybe that maybe is part of their attraction.
Yeah.
They certainly are fascinating, I think, for everyone.
Where do you start when you're trying to explain black holes to people?
I think it depends on the audience a little bit. If I'm talking to a very general audience, where would I start? I'd probably start asking about people, you know, if they've ever heard of black holes. And generally, you will get people who have heard of black holes. And then I'll probably start by, I'll describe a black hole as some region maybe of space that once light travels into that region, it can no longer escape. So it gets stuck in the black hole. And that's the real definition of a black hole. It's black because any light that goes into it just can't ever escape again. And you compare that to something like, like the surface of the Earth. You know, when sun beams light down off the surface of the Earth, that light then reflects back off whatever surface, whether it's a flower or a house or a bicycle, it reflects off that object and into our eye, and we can see those things. The thing with a black hole is that it doesn't reflect anything. Any light that goes into it just gets absorbed, if you like, by the black hole. It can never escape again.
Is that because it's so, there's so much gravity in it, it's so sucky, to use the astrophysical term, that it's not like it's aiming to capture light. It's sucking everything, no matter how massless it is. So light, it's the light bits, the light particles, is it, that it's attracting in, and they're the lightest thing we know. So it's able to suck anything in that isn't vacuum. Is that right?
Yeah, like it, exactly. I think you touched on something very important there. First of all, I'll answer your question. Yes, that's right. Anything that kind of interacts with the black hole gets kind of like sucked in. And everything has what's called an escape velocity. So it's like, if you think, you know, if you were, and so I know we might come to it later, like there's an event horizon around a black hole, which is kind of like the event horizon is like the surface of the black hole.
Yeah.
And once something crosses that imaginary surface, then it, no matter how fast it can travel, so well, that surface is defined by the speed of light, that anything inside that surface can never escape, because light is as fast as anything can travel. And you need to be able to, with anything, like getting off the surface of the Earth, you know, if you need a rock, if you want a rocket ship to get off Earth, you generate a certain velocity. That's called the escape velocity. And basically the escape velocity is the speed of light at that event horizon. So not even light can get out again. It doesn't have enough speed in it, if you like. It just can't ever escape. And another useful analogy is it's a completely invisible surface. Like if you're canoeing towards a waterfall, right, you have a certain velocity, presumably, or speed you can row at. Okay, like depending if you're an Olympic champion, you can row faster, of course. But you also cross an invisible line there as well, right? Like, because, you know, as the current gets stronger and stronger, you'll just cross that line. You'll never know. But there was an escape velocity there at some point that no matter how fast you rowed now, you're going over that waterfall. While if you had stopped beforehand, you know, you're okay. But once you cross that invisible line and there's no, not marked out by an arrow or anything like that or a rope, you go past that line and gravity is going to win. And it's exactly the same thing with a black hole. Something that gets close enough to that invisible line, if it gets too close, it's into the black hole and it never comes out again. And that's why it appears completely black within that event horizon. And that's that by definition is kind of like defines a black hole.
And if you're canoeing over a waterfall, you go over and you fall into a pool at the end. If you go into a black hole, is a black hole a bag? Does it have a bottom? If you know what I mean. I always find it hard to think of space because there's no north, south, east and west. But say I'm coming east to west and I cross the event horizon, and is the black hole sitting like a big Hoover that's lying along a line east to west, and it's got a big Hoover bag and everything gets crushed into it? Would you see the other side of it and see a load of stuff?
This is hard, right? Because so we have really good theories for our universe, you know, general relativity being one of them, which describes as best as we know how basically space-time works, or whatever space is, but it describes our universe really, really well. And we have something like quantum mechanics then, which does a very good job on small scales. But all of our theories break down near a black hole. Mm. And so we can't write down a set of equations that tell us what happens inside of a black hole. Simply, and I kind of use this word a lot, simply beyond our science at the moment.
Yeah.
We just can't probe a black hole. You certainly can't send anything into it. Well, sorry, you can, you know, good luck to you, but it's never coming back out again. And so no signal could ever come back out from it either. So if in the far future, or if you had a very advanced civilization and they could send something into a black hole, as far as we know, that's gone forever. And you could never even, you know, because we send probes, you know, to other planets and around the sun and so on, and they look at the radiation basically coming back from those objects, or we might beam, you know, a radar signal down to Venus or something, we get some information back, and that's all very useful. But a black hole, we could never do that. It doesn't give off any radiation that we could from the black hole, for the inner part itself at least, and we could never probe it with a signal either, because that signal would go into the black hole and that would be the end of the signal.
So our whole understanding of the universe, or even starting with Earth, is left hand side of the equation equals right hand side of the equation, and you measure what goes in, you measure what goes out. What comes out isn't the same shape. Some of it's smoke, dust, fumes, radiation, sound, light, but ultimately left hand side adds up to right hand side. And is that I know there's obviously more complicated equations that get broken, but when you talk about nothing comes out, is that the problem? You throw a lot of stuff in and we have no equations for magic, for disappearing, for stuff.
Well, it's not that. I would say I push back on that a little bit. Like, we do have good equations that tell us that once it goes in, and again, the escape velocity is going to be less than the speed of light, it's stuck there. What I mean is that once we cross that event horizon and we're at speeds that just, you know, in order to get out, we'd have to exceed the speed of light, or like you were saying beforehand, what happens inside a black hole? We don't know really in that regime where you're kind of beyond even strong gravity.
Yeah.
What happens? And like, you'd need probably a quantum theory of gravity, maybe might help you. We're a long way from getting anything like that, or, you know, some version of string theory. We're just miles away from those kind of theories at the moment. So we don't really have anything. We don't even have a left-hand side you could write down.
Yeah.
Or that kind of an arena.
And
so our equations work really well up to the event horizon, yeah. And then that's it. We just don't know what to do.
But that's the enigma that is it probably one of the, you know, so there's lots of unknowns in the universe, you know, how did it begin or where is it going and all that. But is the black hole almost like the best example of the unknown?
Yeah, well, you could be onto something there. That's possibly it. You know, yeah, you probably are. You tied it very nicely as well there, maybe to the Big Bang itself. It's and at some levels are both kind of the same. Our equations break down right at the edge. They break down right at the edge of the Big Bang, and they break down right at the edge of the black hole, and we don't know what comes next. And maybe that's the curiosity part in human nature, right? You're like, no, but what? Because I get asked about this all the time. I don't ask myself anymore because I suppose I'm conditioned to it. But, you know,
so keep your sanity as well.
You know, I don't know. Yeah. And then you give up, and like, it's funny, you stop asking these questions, and well, because there isn't, you know, nobody to ask. You know?
Yeah. I suppose that's why it's fun for science fiction to fill in gaps, because the counterfactual can't be proven. So you can, if you're writing science fiction, if you do all your science right, correct up until the event horizon, the blank slate then is what happens afterwards. So you're in this area now. The blank slate then is what happens afterwards. So you're in this area now. What is the process by which somebody, presumably, who likes maths and likes physics, finds themselves almost by gravity drawn inexorably towards studying black holes? Did you aim for that, or were you studying a passing star and found yourself drawn towards it, a tractor beam on your brain?
I don't know. I think these things are always a bit embryonic, right? You know, like I did my undergraduate degree. I was studying theoretical physics for that. And then I was definitely drawn towards the more cosmology, astrophysics side of that degree. And I then went on to do a PhD. And just when I was doing my PhD, the way it worked was, you know, there was a cohort of us taken in. And you spent the first like 2 months going around talking to people and seeing what projects you'd like to work on. And I talked to one of the researchers there, and he had a project on black holes, black hole seeding. And I was like, oh, that sounds really, really interesting. I'd love to work on that. And it kind of happened like that. It wasn't that I was always myself had this goal in mind and I was going to get to that goal no matter what. I guess I let life take me along that path a little bit as well, but I was kind of picking or trying to work towards the things that I found interesting at the given time, you know. So I was kind of very much living in the present.
Yeah.
Like what interests me at this, you know, this was 20 years ago, I guess now. And I followed that kind of train of thought. I was like, you know, the supervisor has this project that sounds really cool. I would love to work on that. And that's kind of the way it evolved. It wasn't that there was a grand plan or I had this kind of goal I was working towards since I was 10 years old or 8 years old.
I know. But do you think that when somebody starts working on black holes, it's not a subject you'd go, you know what, I'm finished with that now, I'm going to leave it, because presumably there's always one more question to ask.
Yeah, that's true. There is always more. I would also say I think I've been lucky enough. When I started, I started my PhD in 2004, so basically 20 years ago. And there's been huge, huge changes in the field in the last 20 years, I would say. Like that might not be obvious maybe to people from the outside, but it's certainly obvious from people on the inside, because I can see the personal stories as well of people's kind of change of direction and so on.
Yeah. But
there have been big changes in the field, maybe even from the outside. Like if you think, not everybody, but some people will have heard of the gravitational waves.
Yeah.
That were discovered by LIGO, which is this gravitational wave observatory. It's based in the States. And that happened in whatever, 2015, I think it was. And, you know, that was on the front page of every newspaper around the world.
Just to jump in,
Yeah.
Those gravitational waves, were they something that were predicted by mathematics as they must be somewhere? They're a bit on this equation, and what you needed to do was find evidence that they are. So are they things that emanate from a black hole?
They're things that emanate, well, yeah, from black holes, to merging black holes. So when two black holes crash into each other or merge, they in the same way that you throw a rock into a pool, it creates ripples in the water. Two black holes will cause ripples in space-time. Now, space is really tough. You know, we don't even know what space is, but we're pretty sure we don't see it bending. We don't walk around and we see things being bent on top of themselves. So if you want to bend space, you need something very, very hardy to bend it. And it turns out that two black holes crashing into each other, when these black holes merge, are also traveling at half the speed of light when they hit each other. So this is a phenomenally violent collision. And it is tough enough, or generates enough energy, if you like, to bend space. And so you get this ripple effect that that emanates from the merging of these black holes. And you're absolutely right. This was a prediction from general relativity. That in itself had a very, you know, kind of turbulent start, but and Einstein wasn't fully convinced about the argument at the start, actually. In fact, he wrote a paper be hard on the dates now, but it was kind of in the 1930s, so maybe 10 or 15 years after general relativity was released. He wrote a paper, first of all, saying that gravitational waves did not exist. He sent it for peer review. Peer review is where you send it to basically to a journal, and it's sent then to expert referees, and they have a look and be like, not sure, or they're like, yeah, I don't like this, or I think you got this bit wrong. But actually, during the peer review process, I think it was Arthur Eddington, if I remember correctly, sent it back saying, like, you know, Einstein, this guy called Rosen as well, who wrote it with them, said, you've got this wrong. You've got your coordinate system all backwards, basically, and you should change your conclusions. And again, this was the start of the peer review process. So Einstein wasn't used to people giving him feedback, let's say. And he wasn't happy. And he was like, oh, I don't like this peer review business. But as with anything, you know, after your initial emotions down, he did rewrite the paper with the exact opposite conclusions to say that gravitational waves do exist.
And 80 years later, they were found.
Yeah, well, decades and decades. There was a good bit of teasing out through the mathematics then for about another 50 years of whether even if they did exist, would they transport energy? Because if they transport energy, well, can't ever detect them. But the idea then was, yes, they would, and you have to get it out of mathematics.
So if they knew they would transport energy, then they figured it was worth their while building something to detect them.
Exactly. And I think it was like they started building LIGO. So like I said, it detected them in 2015, but the initial building of LIGO started around 1990. They were 25 years trying to detect these things, increasing the sensitivity of the detectors at every stage. So, you know, for the next first 10 or 15 years, the mathematics or the theory, if you like, said, well, you know, you're not going to detect them because your sensitivity isn't there. And they're like, okay, yeah, we know that. But you incrementally increase the sensitivity and you keep going and going and going. And actually what happened then in 2015 is they increased the sensitivity during their maintenance, one of the big maintenance cycles. And they turned the machine on just for engineering tests. And actually, they detected the signal during the test runs. It was absolutely incredible. I think that has been, like, that's been one of the changes in black hole, I guess, observations, you might say, that I've witnessed during my career.
And when something like that happens, and if you were a PhD researcher at the time, or you were maybe at an earlier stage in your career, and you're working away in your area, and then you see the news that they have. Presumably, they spent billions on making a detector to find a thing that an equation predicted 70 years ago.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of stuff that keeps you going? You know, this is an exciting place to be, because I'll do some equations in the hope that one day their results will be confirmed by experiment with a better telescope. Like, is it a real Philip when something like that happens?
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't think I'd be the one creating the equations now, and you know, it took Einstein to do this. But no, 100%. I think it gives huge energy to the field. There's no doubt about that. And you can feel that energy when you go to your meetings, and you get it even through the emails, I suppose, as well. But mostly when you go to conferences after that, you can feel the energy in the room, and people are there's new results coming. There's huge excitement. Old theories are being reinvigorated. Some old theories are put in the bin. So we have a bit of everything going on, and it really does shake the field up. If anything, probably certainly physics, and my guess will be across all of science, always needs a shake up every so often, just because that's where we really thrive, where something has come along and changed the game a little bit and given us a new direction, a new kind of spear almost to follow. And yeah, that's exactly what gravitational waves did. It had been predicted, but there's a huge difference between prediction and observation. Observation is, no, we're on the right track. And usually observations come with a little bit of a caveat. They're like, oh, that's almost exactly what we expected. But geez, did you see that? That was totally kind of like, oh, I didn't think it'd be like that. And there's always a bit of that in it. And observations open, and with gravitational waves, have opened up a completely new window into black holes. It was like one hand was tied behind our back before. So it's been completely fundamental.
Coming up after the break, how John felt when he saw that photo of the black hole, the first photo. Also, we will talk about the benefits of a good walk when it comes to trying to think of something new in the whole theory of black holes. And naturally, we have to talk about time travel. I would be remiss of me not to. And is there a black hole in the room with us right now?
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
How did you feel when you saw the first photograph, or the time that photograph got a lot of attention? And I know that photographs have been refined since and become even better, but what was that moment when they published that image? This might sound like a stupid question. Did it look like you thought it was going to look like? Or did you, within the field, did you know it would be roughly like this? Did you have the same excitement as people who, lay people? Because it does look like you're, when you see a photo of a black hole, like you're looking at the mind of a deity or something. Look at seeing the face of a deity, because it's such an unknowable thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was going to come to that, because I do think that's been the other... The Event Horizon Telescope, which was what they used for those photos. So the two photos of black holes, basically, one in the Milky Way galaxy and one in M87. It's a nearby massive galaxy. So two separate black hole photos. And I do think, they have been huge as well. Try not to use the word massive. So they've been, again, great for the field. I think... for those ones, the photo of the black hole, I think, was important for the general public as well, to show that we're able to do these things. These black holes are there. We're able to take photographs of them now, try and understand the physics about it a little bit better. So there's, I guess, two sides to those kind of photos. One is that some of them are just, are absolutely for the general public, are kind of a PR image. And that's really important for science as well, because, in the way that science works and the way that the funding landscape works, it's very important to keep people engaged with the science, and so that they feel that they are benefiting from it as well. And I think, generally speaking, they do feel that they benefit from this. And they also think that they're, often people want the kids to have good opportunities. And so these are the kind of things that the kids go and learn about in school, and they have the opportunity then, as they grow up, to study these objects as well, and to pursue their own passions. I think the public like to see that, or I certainly hope so. I know is that, we do give a good portrayal of our science and what we're able to do now. We're able to take pictures, very, you know, sophisticated pictures of these black holes. On the scientific side of it, yeah, it's been hugely transformative as well, because you're really probing the region right around the black hole now. That's where the strong gravity, you're in the strong gravity regime, and then, you know, you're also trying to figure out the magnetic fields around these black holes, which is getting more, maybe a bit more into the weeds, but it's had this kind of dual effect, and I think that's been, again, hugely energetic for the field. And then I would say the third thing that has been totally revolutionary has been in the last 18 months is, I'm not sure if your listeners will be familiar with this, James Webb Space Telescope, so JWST. It's launched there on Christmas Day 2021. Kind of had a year and a half or 2 years of those results now. And they have been absolutely mind-blowing as well, because JWST is able to see to greater distances, further back in time, if you like. And we see black holes very early in the universe. Or sorry, we think we see black holes very early in the universe.
What's the nearest one to us?
So that's all a really hard question, right? Because the nearest one that we can see is one of these X-ray binary objects. I don't know which one it is. Like, but there's lots of X-ray binary black holes in the universe. The nearest big one is the one at the center of the Milky Way. And then you'll have hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of small black holes in our galaxy. But most of them are completely invisible for reasons kind of we just discussed. You know, once light goes into them, that's it, it's gone. So we can only see things that light bounces off, basically. So black holes are really hard for us to detect. So one of the near ones would be what's called an X-ray binary object. So you have basically a black hole orbiting around a star, and it's pulling material from that nearby star, and we see that effect. But we don't see the black hole itself, but we see the impact of the binary evolution and the black hole pulling material from that star or stripping that star.
Has anyone ever done any sums, like in the movies, where they work out that a black hole is near us and growing, and in X number of years' time, will gradually consume all around it? Like, do we know if they go on forever? Do they continue to suck stuff in?
So black holes. So yes and no. Generally speaking, yes, but they do. What we think theoretically, they should emit what's called Hawking radiation, which means that at the surface they'll emit a tiny little level of radiation, and over time that would cause the black hole to evaporate. But that's generally offset by the fact that it's, you know, it encounters a tiny bit of gas and it gobbles that up and it grows. So generally speaking, yes, the age of black holes is more or less infinite. They don't really evaporate. The theory goes that some of the smallest black holes, like really, really tiny, minute ones, should have evaporated in the very early universe. Experimental evidence for this is really, really difficult. So, yes.
And the very, very tiny ones, how tiny is tiny?
Measurably tiny masses. But you'd be talking, lots of zeros before it, so 0.00000000 grams. And then they should like flip in and out all the time in the early universe. But see, experimentally, that's going to be very hard for us to probe that kind of regime.
Yeah, like is there one in the room with us right now?
The thing is, if it's small enough, it would evaporate almost instantly. Is there a black hole in the room with us now? It's possible, because we think there's dark matter in the room with us now. And there's a very credible theory that says some portion of dark matter is black holes. So if you take that line of reasoning, it's possible. But again, if they're small enough, they probably wouldn't have an effect. If they're big enough, you'd start to see bending of light by them.
Okay.
You don't see that. And that's how we try to detect actually nearby black holes. You do it through what's called micro lensing. So, you know, if you're looking at images, you stare at a patch of the sky for long enough, you'd start to see kind of almost wobbles in it or like blurring effect. We don't see that. So we don't think there are black holes there. So we can only probe down to certain masses. So we know they're not above a certain mass, but it could be that they're very small and there, and we just couldn't see them.
Yeah. Are you working on anything that is a discovery, or do you look at data that has come in and try and make sense of it? So after, 20 years in the field, has an experiment proven anything that you guessed at, or how does it work?
Yeah, so
thousands of people working their own little areas.
Yeah.
All of your knowledge rolls up to the big thing, I presume, does it?
Yeah, there is a bit of that. It's always evolving. No, I'm first and foremost a theorist. I work on large-scale models of black holes, so I'm trying to figure out how they would have formed in the early universe. And so, like I said, mine has always been theory-driven.
Yeah.
So I have these theories of how black holes can form. And again, the field has evolved. So when I started out 20 years ago, I was completely unencumbered, I didn't have to worry about observations. Do what we wanted, and we could say it's going to be like this. And in 20 years' time, I guess, there'll be telescopes that'll be able to tell us about this. And so now we're at that 20-year phase, which, of course, you never think will happen. And there are observations that are starting to probe the theories that we have put forward. So I suppose my kind of interest now, I'm more and more interested in the observations now as well. But I'm still a theorist, but I do kind of take a very close look now at the observations and I try to understand them a bit more.
Yeah.
But back to your first question. Yeah, I think, we did have, I did a lot of work there with another colleagues from the States a few years ago where we did make some, what I think is holding up, very good predictions for how we think massive black holes form in the early universe. And I think the theory we put forward at the time is probably the leading theory for that at the moment.
Okay. In coming up with this, and I know me trying to understand what you've been doing might be like a dog reading a book, but when you're sitting down, do you sit in a room with a blank wall and start thinking, what if? Like, do you write equations? Do you have some equations and go, well, what if this was tweaked? Are they, where on a scale of a tiny increment based on what we know already plus an infinitely small extra step between that, from there to flight of fancy, do you land on a given Tuesday afternoon when you're having a think?
It's not even though you tweak the equations, it's almost like, what's the right equation to describe what's happening here?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of almost the key. It's not really dreaming up a new theory. It's like, okay, but what of what we know about mathematics and physics, what fits here? What's the right way to think about this? And again, not comparing myself in any way to Einstein, other than Spectrum completely, but Einstein was very good at that as well. He was more thinking, almost laterally, a lot of the things that he put forward, some of them at least, were already there. People knew about them, but they hadn't thought about them in the same way. And he thought about them in a different way. And I think what we were doing is we were taking some older ideas and being like, okay, but how about if we think about black hole formation like this, wouldn't it require, instead of A, B, and C, doesn't it require actually S, Q, and T? And actually, S, Q, and T seem to fit a lot better. And it actually fits much better with the observations show as well now. So it moves the field in that direction. People are like, okay, S, Q, T, that seems much better fit now to what we see. And it's more, it gives us better, what we call number densities, more black holes, basically, and starts to explain our observations a hell of a lot better. So I think it's more, wasn't staring at a blank wall. But it's a combination of things. One, you talk to people and we talk about the results we were seeing through our kind of calculations. And at first they didn't make sense. And we had to move away from ABC to SQT. And then they started making sense. And I remember I was working in DCU at the time, Dublin City University, and I was walking through the campus and I was like, oh, this doesn't make any sense. And I still have that memory actually. And it was, as I was walking through the campus that day, I was like, oh, maybe it's this other way of thinking about it, though. And I had been talking to my colleague in the States about it as well. So it was kind of an incremental journey that we went on himself. It was over months because he was giving a talk about it. And it reminded me, he gave a talk last week about it at a conference I was at, and it reminded me that we did kind of have this over and back for months at a time of what is going on here.
Yeah.
And, we worried our results were, of course, wrong first, and we're like, oh, this maybe doesn't make sense. But actually, it was like that we'd just been thinking about it all wrong, or the community had, the field had, because the field does things like that. There is a herd mentality, and everybody tries to work on one thing, and more people jump on it. And sometimes to shift things to another end of the spectrum can be a little bit hard, but once you're there, everything's starts to make sense. And that's kind of the way that evolved at the time.
Isn't that magic, though, that in the tiny, tiny, squelchy human brain with all its hang-ups, neuroses, worries, you know, the same brain that's worrying about something you said to somebody at a party 3 weeks before. It's also the one that when you're walking through a university campus has, you know, some sort of insight into explaining something that happened billions of light years away. Like, isn't like that, that must feel like, that must be a rush.
Yeah. But I think everybody kind of has that experience, right? Though, like, you know, I remember a lecturer said this to me about, you know, an exam, or, you know, he's telling us preparing for an exam. And he's like, you know, try not to think about things too much. Like, he was giving an example, you know, he'd often be waiting for the bus and he'd come up with like the solution to equations, you know, because I think your brain sometimes works better when it gets a little bit more freedom. You know, if you try to sit down, like I don't really, sometimes it's good to sit down and stare at a wall, fine. But sometimes it's not a good idea to sit down and stare at a wall when you're trying to force things. So I often find, you know, I'm working on a problem and it's always difficult to leave a problem. I think everybody probably finds that. But, you know, obviously, yeah, I have to go home at some point and go collect the kids and all that stuff. And but I'd often be like, I remember I was driving, I don't know if this is the safest thing to do in the world, but I was driving home after collecting the kids yesterday or the day before. And I was thinking of ways to, as I was driving a car, thinking of ways to solve a problem I have with some stuff at work. And you kind of come up with ideas like that, but you're not totally focused on it, but you're kind of like in and out of it. And I find that when I'm cycling home as well, I cycle in now to work mostly, and it's on the bike on the way home, because you kind of almost at this kind of like half tuned in, half tuned out bit. And that seems to work quite well for me. I don't know. I think others probably find the same.
You said something interesting earlier about how earlier on in your career, before all the measurements, you know, that explosion in measuring, how you were, say, unencumbered by, you know, pesky facts, that you could think freer. Is it important that everybody in any given age gets to think silly and free of observation, just because they might come up with a direction about a world which hasn't been measured yet, the unmeasured universe?
I suppose the only thing about that is that you can't go, you know, if you have observations, it's probably not going to be too sensible to think things about, you know, if you have theories that just don't match the observations, that's going to be a harder sell. Like, people do that, especially more in the kind of like more cosmology, particle physics arena, maybe where you have a little bit more scope to be a bit more out there. I think the hope there is that you work through something that you know is completely unphysical, right? That has no boundary in physics, and in fact, you know, the constraints tell you this is simply not true. But that there's some part of it then that leads in another direction. I think that's the hope there. I don't know. I think it depends on the field you're in. Like, if people are working in, you know, exoplanets or something like that, you know, where they're trying to discover new planets, then they are probably in more of a data-driven regime where like they're getting observations and they need to fit to those observations and try and dream up things within that. I think I think probably a one size fits all doesn't approach. But I can see what you mean. A bit of lateral thinking is definitely required for a lot of these things, especially when you're thinking about astrophysics or cosmology or something in that regime where, you know, there are a lot of questions we just don't know the answer to. And this is hard because our observations are always going to be limited. Like, they're improving, I would say, rapidly, exponentially probably, but we're at the very, very start of it as well. You know, if you think about it, like, observations 30 years ago were very, very, very basic. And so I would imagine if somebody looked back in 300 years' time, they'd think the observations we're doing now are almost pointless, you know, because they're so basic. So it's all relative.
I would be remiss of me not to ask in any discussion about black holes. So when can we do time travel when we go into a black hole and come out the other side? How far away are we from that?
A long way away. Like, that's at the exotic end of black holes, right? Like, there is funky stuff that goes on around a black hole, right? Like, if you get, like, it's in a very strong gravity regime, if you get right up against the event horizon, time will stand absolutely still. And it's, you know, it's timeless at that point. Whether we could ever take advantage of these this phenomenon now is certainly in the distant future. Like, I would say the thing about it is, though, it's not like time travel, I think is hard, right? Maybe impossible. But going, you know, you could definitely, the fact that time slowing down is very, very strongly based in physics. And like, you know, we do see that is categorically true. So time being a kind of a dynamic quantity is absolutely true. So could we take advantage someday in the future of the fact that time is not a universal quantity? Absolutely. How we take advantage of it, I think, is less obvious, less clear, but that's definitely something you can physically do. Physics explicitly allows that in much the same way as, you know, heating something up, you know, something as trivial as that. But the physics of time being something you can vary, or that is varied by gravity, is absolutely true as well. So there's no reason that if you had the correct, you know, advanced technology and so on, that you couldn't do something with time. There's no physical barrier to that.
Wow. Yeah. I still can't wrap my head around it, of the idea of time slowing down. I think I might need another couple of hours of podcast.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Well, that's because, you know, we live on Earth and, you know, time is effectively the same absolutely everywhere. You kind of, I suppose this is the thing that, and maybe that goes back to what I said at the start, why we should look beyond the Earth, because we, you know, you get very one-dimensional views of things when you're sitting in that environment all of the time, right? And when we're on Earth, we think of time as being absolutely the same everywhere. But some maybe civilization or something that was more used to, like, oh, well, no, time over there is totally different to time over here. So we can't compare, you know, and you have to get used to that idea. And they see time as more like a river or whatever, you know, like, you know, smoothly flowing parts. And then we're down a waterfall, it's moving much more rapidly. Or if it's going up a hill, it's much more slow. So the time you have to think about is like that. We just don't have that experience.
Yeah.
You know, that's just...
And maybe they're just having a good time, and time is flying for them.
Yeah, there is the relative effects, absolutely.
What is the thing, just to finish up, what's the thing you're most looking forward to in the near future, either finding out or getting to work on? And that is like, oh, in 2030, we're going to know this. I can't wait.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you kind of give me a ballpark number. So in 2034, the European Space Agency will launch what's called the LISA satellite. So that's our mission. That's been completely, I guess, funded or adopted is the word they use. So that's going ahead, barring some massive disaster. Oh, you know, I don't know what happens. But so what that will be is a gravitational wave observatory in space. So it's three satellites, 2.5 million each. There's three of them, and they're 2.5 million kilometers apart. They bounce laser beams between the three of them in a kind of triangular shape. And that is designed to detect gravitational waves from massive, big, big black holes in the distant universe, well, and the nearby universe. And that will be game changing, I think, for black hole physicists like myself. So that's one thing we're really looking forward to. And it's kind of nice. It's 10 years time. It's fantastic to have something like that to work towards. You know, it's a great time now to be, you know, training PhD students and myself in about what we'll do, you know, how we kind of get involved in that, how we position ourselves, I think is maybe the word. And for Ireland to position itself as well, to really take advantage of what that's going to bring around. Because with a mission like that, there's no point 18 months beforehand going like, oh, geez, I should really kind of start, you know, positioning myself to take advantage of LISA. You have to be doing that kind of stuff 10 years out and, you know, really focusing on it, understanding the data that you think you'll get, and then the data you actually get will be totally different, of course, which is the great thing about science. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's going to be huge.
So the next 10 years is a lot of people almost trying to figure out what questions it wants to ask the project.
Yes, exactly. Trying to anticipate what the project will see, because you can't go into these things blind. So you kind of have to inform yourself and then know that you have to be able to have flexibility around those understandings as well, because the universe always, which is a great thing about the universe, it throws us something we didn't expect. If it's anything like the last 10 years, I suspect LISA will be absolutely electric for the field and will give us a huge amount to think about, a huge amount of work on. We generate a lot of excitement, lots of graduates working on it. And it's great for, I think it's great for society. And it's great for, you know, young students coming into the field. They have this telescope they'll be able to work with the data on. They're working at right at the edge of science. You know, like if I was 20 years younger and you were coming into this and somebody told me, here, if you want to come in and work on a project about gravitational waves because we're sending up a mission in 10 years' time, geez, that would be fantastic news, right?
And finally, if I see one, I always ask, is there any what's written on the whiteboard behind you? Is it lots of interesting equations about black holes, or is it just applying for
equation heavy at the moment? It's usually trying to plot the path for student projects.
Okay.
That's what it is usually. It's like trying to give, you know, when I have students in the room, I'm like, okay, I think we should do this plan next. That's usually the way we get it. The equations get rubbed off.
There's no equation with a lot of exclamation marks off it.
No, say, not today.
We have 30 years left. Yeah, good. Yeah, that's needed too. Thank you so much, John Regan. Thanks for coming into the Function Room.
Thanks very much.
Okay, that was Function Room 49. Thanks very much to Dr. John Regan. Nearly at number 50, inching towards it painfully slowly. I know. Another 4 weeks since the last one. Just been very busy. But given that we're dealing with something like black holes and things happened 55 million years ago or 10 billion years ago, 4 weeks is but the blinking of an eye. So I'll try and get some more out over the next few weeks. As ever, let me know what you think. And if you see any black holes, don't approach one. Please call the appropriate authorities. They may appear friendly, but they will suck you in and then spaghettify you and crush your body down to unimaginable densities, and I don't think anybody wants that. We have enough on our plate without having you on our plate. So if you enjoy the Function Room, let me know. Suggest new topics or guests. I'd love to hear from you. But that's it for me, Colm O'Regan in the Function Room. Till next time. Bye bye.